This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, former Western Michigan University quarterback Tim Hiller discusses football, faith, and life in his book, Strive. Life is short. Pursue what matters. But first, in advance of Veterans Day on Wednesday, a series of events are being held on the Western Michigan University campus. A panel discussion on Monday is titled Military Family Life, Families, Service Members, and Veterans. WMUK's Andy Robbins spoke with retired U.S. Army Colonel Angela Pereira, who will be part of Monday's panel discussion.
Colonel Pereira, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Andy. I'm happy to be speaking with you today.
You come from a military family yourself, right?
I do. I was actually born into a military family. I'm an Army brat. My father was an NCO. My mother was a homemaker. And I spent most of my adult life related to the military.
What are the biggest misconceptions do you think that civilians have, those who have never served in the military, have about being in a military family?
Well, I think that it goes both ways. Sometimes they overestimate the challenges, which are significant. But there are so many of us doing it that we know that they can be overcome. And sometimes people now, our society as a whole, is pretty removed from the military. They see the military responsibility as somebody else's job. So it's kind of a mystique to them. They don't know some of the challenges that we face either, especially the frequent relocations and the separations. Those are probably the hardest things to deal with in a military family.
Now, you've said that, you know, there are advantages to coming from a military family, but let's talk about those challenges first. And you mentioned one, the ongoing deployments we've had in recent years. What kind of issues does that raise for a military family?
Well, it's hard on a military family. It's hard because the member who has been gone has to work their way back into the family. Meanwhile, everybody else has shifted to fill in the holes. So roles change significantly. Then the military member who has been gone has been through lots of experiences, good and bad, that they're still dealing with, and they bring those home with them.
What can you do to help families in that situation?
Well, you have to provide a lot of support to families in that situation. And a lot of support especially has to be given to the non-deployed or the non-separated parent, especially because that's what gets the kids through the separation. If the parent who is there at home with the children is doing well, then usually the children will do well because it's that attachment that's very important to the well-being of the child.
Are there special challenges when both parents are in the military?
When I was in Iraq for my second deployment, I had a couple who were both there at the same time. And for them, it was childcare during the year that they were gone. But also, they had no idea if their children were going to have one parent, two parents, or no parents at the end of the war. So that was very difficult for them.
How did they get through that?
I think they were very religious. They prayed a lot, and they had family members who, extended family members who came in and took over the roles of parenting while they were gone. And I think that's very important always with military families and the changes that they have to go through. They're often separated from those families, but yet they're so vital to keep them healthy.
What other challenges might there be for military families beyond those that we've mentioned, the deployments, the child care and that sort of thing that perhaps civilians just don't have to think about?
There are a lot of challenges that military, that non-military families go through that are shared by military families. However, on top of that, they have to have concerns about operational tempo. In other words, how often duty calls first, and then spouse employment. If the spouse is trying to have a career, it's very difficult with somebody coming in and out of the family or moving a lot. There's child care, and of course you have to shift child care routines and roles and expectations. There are financial changes, especially with the reserve component. The times that they're on active duty versus not on active duty, there's a lot of financial changes in there. It could, if they're trying to keep a career at the same time, it really negatively impacts on that career. And as a family, it negatively impacts on their finances for the family. There are dual military families. One I just talked about is a real problem. And I don't think that most people who don't know the military have a concept of what that might mean to a family. And then there's transition from being a military family to being a civilian family, and for reservists, that goes the other way too.
Does the Defense Department have programs to, say, help someone who's, let's say, marrying into a military family who is not themselves in the military to, you know, kind of give them a heads up about some of these things?
Well, we don't have programs like that. What we do have is family networks that are set up by the units that are prepared to educate people coming into the military or spouses coming into the military about what military life is about and to try to provide support during that process.
But that's a sort of an informal thing then.
That's informal. Yeah, we don't have a military 101, unfortunately, for people who are coming in to the military or spouses who are marrying into the military.
Now, you mentioned the issue of, you know, reservists, someone who's not been on active duty but then is called up. That obviously could be disruptive to a family. What about the person who, as you mentioned, is leaving the military, is about to become a veteran, and sort of that exit strategy, that can be kind of stressful too, apparently.
It's very stressful. But there are transition programs that are set up to help people do that, but that only goes so far. They don't actually get out and find you a place to live or find you a job that you can slide into after you've left active duty. So there are lots of issues, financial issues too, because many times those families have a huge financial loss at that point during separation. And if you're retiring, you're an older military person coming out of the military, maybe, you know, 20 to 30 years, you're older and you're hitting the job market as an older citizen. And that's sometimes a barrier.
Do you find that the people who have spent virtually all of their adult lives in the military have problems readjusting to civilian life, whether or not they were in combat, because the way of military life is so different from what it is in civilian life?
Yes, and sometimes it's the things like the camaraderie, the esprit de corps, it's the sense of belonging that you have in the military. Then there, in my case, I retired as a colonel, and a lot of my peers told me, you're really going to miss the power that you had. In my case, that wasn't true. But in many cases, I can understand how that would be true.
Sort of a loss of identity then.
The loss of identity, the loss of belonging, and then trying to fit into a civilian society where nothing is as structured. Nothing follows lines that you expect it to. There's no chain of command. There's, you know, no SOP about how to go about doing things and living your life.
So if you go into civilian life and you become a manager, you can't deal with your employees in the same way that perhaps you dealt with your subordinates in the military.
Yes, that's very true. I think that's absolutely true. And sometimes that is a difficult change. But then, you know, it's not all about power. A lot of it's about leadership, and you learn a lot of leadership skills. And team, working as a team during your time in the military. And that translates very well to every job.
And that sort of leads into the next question. You've said that obviously there are challenges that we've just talked about being part of a military family. But you say there are some big advantages, too. What are those?
Education, for one. You know, I feel that... I got a very good education being a family member going to the schools that I went to. You learn how to make friends. You learn how to adapt to different situations. You have not only education and while growing up or being a child in the military, but also when leaving the military. There are lots of educational benefits. The pay for most careers is relatively good. It may not be for the, you know, some of the professional careers. They may take a little bit of a loss in pay, but for the rest of us, the pay is good. A lot of attention is taken to help you with a successful career. So there are a lot of advantages to military life.
If there were one or two things you would like your civilian audience to take away about what they should know about military families, what would they be?
Military families are very resilient. We have a fear right now that because of all of the deployments that military families are falling apart. Well, actually, the research doesn't say that, doesn't prove that that's going on. And they seem to be doing fine, especially with support. And this generation of military children, yes, some of them are at risk, but many of them not. Most of them are not. Most of them are very resilient. Families are doing fine. Good in spite of multiple deployments, but we do worry about some problems that we've seen as a result of the long wars we've just finished. Abuse, divorce, especially among women, long-term effects of PTSD and TBI, and suicide. So we still have a lot of work to do.
You use that term TBI. What does that mean?
I'm sorry, traumatic brain injury, when you get hit by a hard object or shrapnel or just the results of a bomb, being close to a bomb and getting some of those airwaves knocked against your brain. So it's a strike to the brain. Military families are very resilient, but they can definitely use our support to do the things, to be able to continue to do the things that they're doing in taking care of our nation.
Angela Pereira, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, you're welcome, Andy. It was my pleasure.
Retired Colonel Angela Pereira will be part of a panel discussion called Military Life, Families, Service Members, and Veterans. It begins at noon on Monday in Western Michigan University's Bernhard Center. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Tim Hiller set records for yards, completions, and touchdown passes as Western Michigan University's quarterback from 2005 to 2009. After graduation, he pursued a career in the NFL. He signed as an undrafted free agent with the Indianapolis Colts. He would also have stints with the Chicago Bears, Kansas City Chiefs, and New England Patriots. Tim Hiller now works for Stryker Corporation. He's a motivational speaker and the author of Strive, Life is Short, Pursue What Matters. He tells of his experiences on and off the field, his faith, and how he believes that people can lead more fulfilling lives. Tim Hiller, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Gordon.
Let's begin with the idea of writing a book. What made you want to put these ideas onto paper?
Yeah. You know, I was really challenged by a mentor. I didn't actually set out to write a book when this whole process began. In 2010, you referenced I was released by the Indianapolis Colts, and that was a hard time for me. It was a time of, you know, readjusting and trying to figure out what's next, what's the next plan. And as a mentor, he was the pastor who eventually married my wife and I. He challenged me to write about that, and he challenged me to kind of journal, and I was no good at it. I not really a Dear Diary type of person. And so as I wrote some entries, I shared them with a few people, and it really grew. You know, you'd email it one to somebody, and it'd get forwarded to 5-6 other people, and it kind of spread, and got some feedback that I should consider starting a blog. And I, again, hadn't thought about that. How do I do that? And did some research, and it led into a blog called Encouragement. And it was really about helping people see a need in their community or in their church or in their family, and then to use their gifts to meet that need, just simple service. And again, that grew and kind of spread and grew in following. And it was now late 2012, and I was at the HumanX Impact and Legacy Leadership Summit in downtown Kalamazoo. And I'm sitting in the back of the room. I'd been given some free tickets, free passes, and there was no one at my table. And I came to find out that the reason was because it was the keynote speaker's table. And so I ended up having lunch with the likes of Sue Enquist, who was a legendary softball coach at UCLA. Tom Izzo was a keynote that day. And one other keynote was a guy named Adrian Gostick. And Adrian is a best-selling business author and consultant, wrote books like The Carrot Principle and All In and What Motivates Me. And he and I just struck up a great conversation, and his son was a football player, a high school athlete. I was still coaching at the time, and we stayed in touch, and I sent him a link to the blog, and he responded a while later and said, you know, I've read a lot of your entries. You need to get published. And it hadn't even crossed my mind. And so he really kind of mentored me through that, gave me very critical feedback at times, and was really a key signpost on that journey towards Strive being published.
So you mentioned sitting at the table where the keynote speaker was, sort of by accident. You begin this book with a story about sitting, I guess you could say, in the wrong seat, and what it taught you about how sometimes you have to make a change and your plan becomes different. Explain that.
Oh, yeah. So kind of an embarrassing moment in many ways. I'm thankful that the subject of that story, who's Peyton Manning, the legendary quarterback, was not in the room when this happened, thankfully. But I share this story sometimes when I speak. You know, I came in and my wife would call me an extreme nerd, but I'm always, you know, sit first in the class, sit in the front row. It's just kind of a habit I developed my time at Western, and, you know, just trying to be a studious individual, and sat in the front row. I was getting ready for the meeting. He said, you can't sit there. So I slid over a chair, and he said, well, you can't sit there either. And I'm like, okay, is this rookie hazing? Why? You know? And he says, well, that's where Peyton puts up his feet. And he did. True to form. I learned that a couple of days later when he was in the meeting. So I took my rightful place in the back of the room where the rookies belong. But it was a good reminder for me as I reflected on that experience that we go through that same cycle over and over in life. You know, we climb, we establish ourselves in our career, and then we retire and we have to find a new purpose or a new meaning. Or, you know, maybe we're growing in our education, then we get thrown out in the professional world and it's like, wow, I thought I knew it all, and I really don't. I have experiences to gain, and life is a journey of rising up and then being humbled again. And so that's what I try to capture in that and what we can learn.
Pursuing a career in professional sports, you know, I think it perhaps provides a bit of a paradox here. It is a very competitive field. Only a few people can do it. So you really have to throw yourself into that if you're going to be successful. At the same time, even a successful NFL career, maybe 10 years. And so you're in your early 30s and you got the rest of your life to live. So you still have to kind of plan for something later. Did you have to balance those two things? The idea that, yes, I want to play in the NFL. And at the same time, I know that won't be my whole life, and there's other things I want to do.
Absolutely. I mean, you touch on something so powerful, and that's one of the things that I get very passionate about, is that I write about it. There's an entry called Identity Crisis, and I talk about that. There's a little boy. My wife is a kindergarten teacher, and there's a little boy that came up to me the day I volunteered in a class, and he said, what do you do? And at the time he asked me that, I was unemployed. I was between NFL teams, and it was like, wow, I don't know right now, you know, and my identity is tied up in what I'm doing and not who I am. And I think that's a powerful thing for athletes. It's very hard because sports in our society is all encompassing. Parents spend all this money on travel teams. You invest all these hours. You maybe have an injury you overcome. I've had multiple injuries I've had to overcome. And so you invest so much of yourself into it that you begin to think, this is who I am. I'm a football player. I'm a basketball player. And you're more than that. You have other gifts and talents, you have other skills. And for me, it was going through that trial of having to understand that. And I think we all experience those identity crises throughout our life in different ways as life moves and changes.
When you write about that encounter with the kindergartner, you also say at the time you felt like a failure.
Hmm.
I mean, kind of, you know, take us to where you were at that point, because that's a pretty strong word.
It is, and it's intentional because it is the way I was feeling. For me, what you referenced, Gordon, you know, as a professional athlete, you have to have a certain level of confidence. And so for me, this sounds almost arrogant, but there was no plan B. I mean, there was no doubt in my mind that I was at least going to do that for 3, 4, 5 years. And after that, we'll figure it out. But I'm going to be here for a while. And that wasn't God's plan. He had different plans. And so it's very challenging to step back from that. And I was embarrassed. You know, I had had a lot of success at Western Michigan University. I'd had success, you know, at the lower levels in high school. I'd always worked hard, but some things came easily to me. And then you're in a situation where all of a sudden the tables have turned. And so I did very much feel like a failure for my own goals. I felt like an embarrassment in some ways. And, you know, I think part of that process was how Strive was birthed. And hopefully that other people can, you know, you earn credibility as a leader when you're able to be vulnerable and just say, you know, I'm not perfect. I make mistakes and I can be open about those.
Your faith is obviously very prominent in your life and throughout this book. Did you grow up in a strong religious background?
I did. So my parents were originally Catholic, and then I was raised in the Methodist church, and there's a whole story behind that. But again, that discipline and structure, you know, we were always there, every youth group, every Sunday. And as young as probably age 11 or 12, Gordon, I would have told you I was a Christian, but I didn't know what that meant. And I didn't know that I didn't know what that meant until I came to Kalamazoo and I came to Western, and I went through a severe injury and sat out the entire 2006 season. And it was during that kind of trial experience that I had to make a decision. Is this God real or not? Is this faith my own or is it my parents' faith? And so for me, it was getting away from home, out from under the cover of my parents' roof, to go through that experience of saying, okay, is this real? And I found it to be. And since then, I think the thing about faith is if you picture that like aerial view of a hurricane on a weather map, you know, faith is like the vortex of your life, if it's a part of your life. And that's a high call that some people are afraid of. But you know, Jesus demands it's either me at the center and everything revolves around me, or, you know, choose a different path in some ways. And so for me, once I came to understand that, it really became that vortex. And football in some senses meant less and less to me. And it was more about, how do I use that platform? You know, he's given me this captive audience, not saying that's right, but that's the way our world works, that they're fascinated by athletics. How am I using this? I saw wasted opportunities that I'd wasted for years rather than, it was more focused on me and achieving my goals rather than stepping back and being a role model and doing some of those things that I was capable of doing.
And there's an interesting story you have in the book about when you set the record at Western for most touchdown passes. And you say you found your mind kind of drifting there a little bit, maybe feeling a little too full of yourself or thinking a little more than it's too much about you and not what it meant and the people who'd contributed to it.
Yeah. I'm glad you referenced that entry, because what I would say about that was a hard entry to write, because there's a certain element of, boy, this is kind of some ugliness in my mind that do I really want to share this with other people? But I think we all think those thoughts at some point. And I think what I realized at that point, and one of the things that helped me, is the former record holder at that point was a guy named Tim Lester, who coached me for 2 years. Bronco fans would know that, you know, he's such a legend. And in the late 90s, early 2000s, just rewrote the record books here and under Coach Cubitt's tutelage.
Now the offensive coordinator at Syracuse,
that's
right?
Yeah, yeah. He's back there with Scott Schaefer at Syracuse. Really a mentor and a friend in my life. But to get to that point, I'd really stood on the shoulders of giants. I had great coaches in high school. I had great players around me, a great line, a great coach like Tim, who basically taught me to do what he had done. Our accomplishments are so much the product of other people's investments in us. And so it was snapping out of that selfishness that you referenced that I tried to articulate in the entry, and really stepping back and saying, I have a lot of other people to be thankful for.
So when you were released by the Colts, and as you say, this was a tough time for you, did you find yourself at any point questioning your faith?
I did. You know, there was kind of a breaking point I remember hitting. I got back from Kansas City, and the trip to Kansas City was a disaster. So it was kind of the end of the season. It's like, okay, this is one last chance to get in. It's like week 15, 16, coming down the playoff run. Might be able to sign on for the playoffs and then move into camp next year. And that was the goal. And it was like my flight got delayed out of Kalamazoo. I had to like sprint to Chicago's plane. They had already shut the door and they reopened it for me, which like never happens, you know? So it was just like everything that went wrong could go wrong. You know, I'm sitting in the seat and they have to reread all the security protocol and people are looking at me like, oh, I hate you. You know, just it was a nightmarish experience. And I remember getting back from that and got a call and they said, we really like you, but we're not sure what we're going to do. So, you know, kind of thanks, but no thanks for now. And, I just remember I just sat down in the bedroom on the floor and just cried. I was just like, man, like I'm just working so hard at this. It would be so much easier if somebody would have said to me, you're just not good enough. You know, you're just not tall enough. You're just not strong enough. You've had too many injuries. Your arm's not good enough. But I never got that answer, not from any team. I mean, they all said, we like you, we just don't have the numbers right now. Or we like you, but we need to bring in a running back because we're thin on the depth chart. We can only have 53 at a time, you know? And it was just always like that excuse answer. And that was just so hard because I was doing everything in my power. I was striving, as the book would say, I was striving for that and it just wasn't working out. And so, you know, that was a hard time, but again, pulling back and gathering that perspective that God had bigger and better plans.
I want to ask you about a couple of other football-related things. During the time you were playing at Western and then in your time in the NFL as well, we were learning a lot more about head injuries, concussions, those sort of things. You were interviewed by the Kalamazoo Gazette about on this subject as well. Based on what we know now, is there still more that needs to be done in terms of making sure, you know, you said you played with a concussion in high school. You know, is that the sort of thing you look back on and you say, gosh, well, what were we doing?
Right.
You know, sort of, you know, the parent grows up and says, yeah, I might have done that when I was a kid, but I don't want my kid to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point. So, yeah, and I was thankful, you know, over all those years, I only suffered one concussion, which is somewhat amazing compared to the data and the statistics we see now. I think now the way we define a concussion, I may have had two or three, but at the time I didn't. I think the best thing that we've done, and this is coming a little bit from wearing my former coach's hat, is instituting a good protocol with good expectations for parents and their sons or daughters. In that, you know, we had a great back to game protocol where if there was an injury, we're going to wait until all symptoms completely went away. And then there was some physical testing. And if and only if the physical testing could be done with no symptoms, then you could return to like full conditioning, but not even full contact until another couple of days had passed. And so that type of rigor, I think, is needed because when you're most vulnerable for another concussion is when you've just had one and you're still recovering. So I think that is important. You know, equipment has come a long way. I've seen it evolve a long way in my short career, but I think what we've learned is that equipment doesn't totally prevent concussions. And so it's really, to me, that protocol and that partnership with the parent and the athletic trainer is really important. And it's also just that education. I think it has scared some people away from the game. And that's a shame because football is a great game and it teaches lessons like no other sport I know. And I think that we've seen participation dip, but I think there are things we can do to mitigate that. Playing flag for a longer period of time before contact is introduced. Being very vigilant about using like USA football type of standards when we teach tackling, so we're teaching it appropriately all the way through the youth levels. I think those type of things are really important measures for the game moving forward.
You have a son, correct?
I do.
At some point, is it going to be okay with you if he wants to put on a helmet and play tackle football?
It is, but he's not going to play until his age is right. You know, for me, I had a great experience. I grew up in Northeast Ohio, and I didn't play tackle football until I was 13 in seventh grade. I played flag when I was younger. And I think there's, beyond concussions, it's not even about that. It's about learning those finer skills and getting to try the different positions. I mean, you learn how to appropriately throw a ball and catch a ball and tuck a ball. Blocking and tackling are complex skills. And I'd rather see a kid master the basics and then add those later when he's older and bigger and stronger. And I saw this a lot when I was a head coach at the high school level, that we'd have kids that, you know, they were small, undersized, they had a bad experience, they took a big hit, and they gave up the game. And then here they are, sophomore in high school, 6'2", 220 pounds. And it's like, man, you could have, you know, had a future if you'd given the game a little bit more of a shot. So I think it's about just helping kids have a great experience, appreciate the game, and learn the basics.
Do you want to write more?
I do. I've tinkered a little bit. I've started something very, very, very much in its infancy, but I do. I hope to continue to write more over the years and just continue to share with others. I think it's really about paying it forward.
Tim Hiller, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Tim Hiller's book is called Strive, Life is Short, Pursue What Matters. Tim Hiller will be signing copies of his book, Strive, at the Michigan News Agency from 6 until 8 p.m. on Tuesday, and on Saturday, November 14th, from 1 until 3 p.m. at the Barnes & Noble on Westnedge Avenue in Portage. Links with more details can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.